Case number 20-1339, Anas Alhadi versus unidentified CBP agents et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. And Mr. Kason Ross for the appellant. You may proceed when ready.
This case to be decided on Abbasi grounds?
We are,
Honor?
Right, and that wasn't before either the district court or the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court remanded for the Court of Appeals to consider the Bivens sua sponte, correct?
I think I followed that correctly. And
I didn't explain it well, but you're right.
Okay, go ahead. Absolutely, Your Honor. But if it does decide to take up the Bivens question, the court must consider whether special factors counsel hesitation before creating a Bivens remedy here, and it absolutely does. There are special factors for involving border security and immigration enforcement that require sensitive consideration of constitutional separation of powers.
There's no diplomatic issue like there was in Hernandez, is there?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Just completely might as easily have happened in downtown Cincinnati as far as foreign relations are concerned.
So far as foreign relations are concerned, I suppose that's the case.
Which seemed to me to be the main thing that was, not the only thing, but the main thing that was going on in Hernandez.
But it certainly wasn't the only thing, Your Honor.
This is at the border, right?
It is at the border, yes.
And the plaintiff alleges, although you don't confirm, that there was a reason the officers detained
him. That's correct, Your Honor.
And so, based on what the Supreme Court said in the 2020 version of Hernandez, that would be pertinent. In other words, they talk about national security and things like that.
That's correct. Of course, the reason for plaintiff's detention here was shielded by the law enforcement privilege. But it's worth taking just a step back to consider the circumstances under which he was detained. This was a Customs and Border Patrol officer who was a counterterrorism official who was, as plaintiff himself recognizes in his response brief, he was questioned about terrorists and association with terrorists that has a close...
So not to interrupt you, but I think it's fair to say the Supreme Court would put this at the same level as maybe foreign relations.
That's a fair characterization, Your Honor. And in the Fifth Circuit has also explained, albeit in dicta, that proximity, the Supreme Court has suggested that proximity to the border itself suggests that that may be a context in which Bivens is just unavailable. That is certainly something for the court to consider here, as well as the fact that...
But there's no case that says that other than Hernandez, though, is that right? Which is pretty distinguished. But not totally.
That border security alone is sufficient? Sorry, I'm not sure I followed Your Honor's question.
We're not bound by precedent to say that this fits within Abbasi. And the closest thing we have is Hernandez, am I right so far?
It is also worth returning to a decision from the Fourth Circuit, Juncos, as well as the Third Circuit in Vanderklok.
So you have other circuits which have looked at this.
Correct. To my knowledge, Your Honor, there is not a decision from this court or the Supreme Court other than Hernandez that is squarely on point.
Is this case, does it have similarities to the facts in Bivens or not, Bivens itself?
Whatever factual similarities there are to the circumstances in Bivens itself, Your Honor, they're sufficiently distinguishable for this to be a meaningful new context. In Abbasi, the Supreme Court itself recognized that the factual circumstances there were, quote, parallel to the circumstances in Bivens itself. And
was that Bivens a Fourth Amendment case also, and this is not?
That is correct, Your Honor. I was going to say that the Supreme Court also recognized in Abbasi that there were practical considerations in both Bivens and Abbasi that made the cases very similar. But the fact that there was a different constitutional right at issue is in itself sufficient. Additionally, this case concerns a temporary border facility. It is at the border. It is a completely different agency than the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. And as I said, it involves another constitutional right. All of these reasons are why this case is meaningfully different from Bivens itself. And the district court itself found as much, and I don't understand plaintiff's supplemental brief to take a different argument. In that light, as I said, border security and immigration enforcement provide reason to hesitate here because the constitutional separation of powers require courts to be hesitant before creating new remedies in contexts where Congress has not otherwise provided one. With that, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Very well. Any further questions at this point?
No, thank you, Mark.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'd like to start with the Bivens question that did not dispute that issue of jurisdiction. There was a jurisdictional argument below. That jurisdictional argument related to that the plaintiff appellees claimed that because the defendants had raised the issue of Bivens at the motion to dismiss stage and did not appeal that, that they had waived that it would be an untimely appeal. That was the only jurisdictional issue.
Well, how do you deal with Carlson in our case and Cabruti in 2010? Cabruti clearly said we have jurisdiction, and Carlson said, Carlson's a forfeiture case, but also said that judicial administration would be served best by addressing the antecedent question.
I apologize for not knowing the Cabruti case off the top of my head. As far as the Carlson case, that was a case on final judgment. The court had ruled against the plaintiff at the district court level, and so the entire case was up. And that's the difference between that case and a case here where the Bivens issue would only be available, if at all, as a pending jurisdiction issue. You know, on an appeal of a final judgment, the court can affirm a district court judgment on any grounds of the
record. As the Fifth Circuit pointed out, it seems kind of odd for a plaintiff to say, well, I don't have to show that I have a cause of action at all. As the Fifth Circuit points out, that the burden's really on you, not the government, to demonstrate you have a cause of action by which you can bring this lawsuit. And then let me read you Wilkie. It is Wilkie v. Robbins. It's the same thing you and I are. We're talking about the same case. We recognized just last term that the definition of an element of the asserted cause of action was directly implicated by the defense of qualified immunity and properly before us on interlocutory appeal.
Yes.
And so that was an interlocutory appeal, or not Wilkie, but Hartman was, where they recognized it first.
Yes, and in Wilkie, the court does say that in two sentences, but it was not an issue briefed by the parties. My view is
well, what about Hartman? They're quoting Hartman, and it clearly is directly implicated by the defense of qualified immunity and properly before us, and that's the Supreme Court saying it.
I don't believe Hartman was an interlocutory appeal either, but I don't want to say that with enough confidence. But I will say, and Wilkie, the issue wasn't briefed, and I don't know the Fourth Circuit test either off the top of my head at the time Wilkie was decided, so it may be that the Fourth Circuit test might have been more like the Third Circuit test for pendant jurisdiction, or the where the issue is defined as intertwined, but that's different than the Beals test, which the Sixth Circuit follows, which requires not only inextricably intertwined, but as my various speakers have said during his speech, these are two logically distinct analyses, but that also needs to be necessary to decide the question. The Department of Justice, in their abundant wisdom, could appeal this case all the way, could move for summary judgment, argue it, and appeal it without mentioning the word Bivens once, then I don't think you can say that it's necessary to decide the Bivens issue.
So, counsel, just so I'm straight, you're representing El Hadi, right?
Yes.
And your position is that we should not reach the Bivens issue
because
this is a limited appeal that just relates to qualified immunity. Is that your position?
Yes, you should not reach the Bivens issue for two reasons. One,
not because we absolutely can't, but we shouldn't, or you say we absolutely cannot.
I don't think you have the jurisdiction to do it. I don't think you need to reach the jurisdictional
question. We don't have the jurisdiction?
I don't think you have the jurisdiction because I don't think it falls within pendant jurisdiction on an interlocutory appeal of qualified immunity.
Well, okay. So you disagree with the Supreme Court. I'm sorry, Judge Rogers. Go ahead.
Just assume that we think that it could colorably be part of the actual qualified immunity analysis.
Do you have
any argument then that it just wasn't raised and therefore
yes.
This is a civil case and it's not a jurisdictional issue, we're assuming. So where it isn't prudent, we don't have to do it and we shouldn't do it. That's your fallback argument. I'm just trying to figure out what the various parties are arguing.
Yes, that's our other argument. Actually, I think that's our principal argument. I just wanted to go and read the order that it was.
Right. Your principal argument then, if we assume that we get to it, is that there's no qualified immunity, right?
Yes, if you get to the qualified immunity issue, our argument is there's no qualified immunity.
And what's your main? The Supreme Court just recently said you need cases to support that there's a constitutional violation, which go
similar for a couple of, there's a couple of important points in Spencer. One is that the court did not make the types of very narrow fact findings that that wanted to be here. The court did not even determine how cold the cell that was being complained of. It said that any doubts about the cell, I'm not quoting, but paraphrasing, any doubts about the cell's temperature is made up for by the extended amount of time. So there wasn't a time difference, but it wasn't, the court didn't rely on the time difference except as to excuse the lack of information.
Which court was this now? So I'm straight. I'm sorry to be.
This was the Sixth Circuit.
So this is our court.
Yes.
And what's the final holding, that there was qualified or there was not?
There was no qualified immunity. There was not no qualified immunity. The court didn't address qualified immunity. The court found a violation.
Can you give me the site?
The court found
the site for Spencer. Sorry, I'd have to. Sorry, I'll grab it off my brief.
I can get it. Don't worry. I'm
sorry.
That's all right. I don't want to take your time.
Yeah, I'm confused with the holding of the case was.
The holding of the case was that there was a 14th Amendment violation.
Oh, wasn't a qualified immunity. It just went straight to whether it was a violation in that case.
Yes, but
that's,
I think
an even stronger. If you're saying there's no qualified immunity, that would be even stronger than a qualified immunity case.
Well,
it deals with what the law is, not what a reasonable person could have found what the law was.
Our argument is that Spencer, I'm not sure I understand your question, but our argument is that Spencer established the law.
Right.
And Spencer, although it was to address the question that was raised in the opening, Spencer was a, as I said, 14th Amendment issue. It relies on Burchett, which is a, Burchett, I think, was also, I can't remember whether Burchett was also a 14th or a 4th Amendment issue, as well as Holt, which was a, no, Burchett was a 4th Amendment issue. And it also relies on Hope, which was a 8th Amendment issue.
Can I ask you about Spencer now that I've gotten it up? Because it says cell continuously for several months, coupled with leaking ceiling constituted serious deprivation to support inadequate shelter claim. Right? So several months, the Supreme Court just this week, I think, pointed out we have to find similar rights and similar facts. Several months sounds different than several hours.
So there are two questions in there, and I'll answer the second question first and the first question second. The Supreme Court's recent decision, as our response to the Notice of Supplemental Authority explains, was specifically in the context of excessive force decisions, and the court said that it's specifically in that context. It's not.
Right, but for example, in Revis, the court says we have to find specific cases, and they even questioned our ability to look at our own cases. They said even assuming we can rely on our own cases versus their cases for a clearly established right. Right? We have to find the same facts, same right.
Well, on the even assuming, every court I believe has assumed that to be correct, and I don't know if any court has gone contrary ever. As far as a year ago in Taylor, the Supreme Court found in a conditions of confinement case, different than an excessive force case, that the fairly bad conditions of confinement at prison, there did not need to be a case with the same facts, that any reasonable person would know that that even without a case on all four, that you can't leave somebody in their own feces for only 8 days. I think, don't hold me on the number of days.
That's right.
And the court goes on to cite Hope for that proposition in Taylor, because Hope and Burchett, which relies on Hope, defines the right at a higher level of generality. So the idea that the whole level of generality is just no longer valid because of these two Supreme Court decisions, I don't think you can say that.
Well, Westby said that too. I mean, there's a long line of Supreme Court cases that say don't define it at a high level of generality.
I think when the Supreme Court requires facts on the very specific facts on the same level, it is almost, as far as I'm aware, it's always involving the Fourth Amendment context, either on the search and seizure question or on the excessive force question. The court does so because of case law that it says that it would be unfair to require police officers making split-second decisions to have to narrowly split second decision cases. Conditioned confinement cases rarely, if ever, are. You know, Mr. Bradley had 4 hours to decide not to keep Mr. Ahadi in freezing cold conditions, to deny him a blanket, to deny him his shoes, deny him a jacket, all of which he was screaming for until he, you know, passed out from the cold and required hospitalization for decreased core temperature.
Is that is chilling people literally? Is that cause them to stay more? I mean, is that does that work? I mean, is that what's going on? Maybe here is that, or is it just sort of, you know, we don't care about these people?
I think in the original complaint we thought that might be going on. I think discovery indicated that the problem was not freezing them out of a desire to freeze them, but that there was a faulty HVAC system that kept that room incredibly cold, or sometimes incredibly hot. If you look at their 2018 emails in the record that showed that in 2018 they did
so
not.
So how could that be a constitutional violation if it's just negligent attention to the HVAC?
I think it would have to be more than negligent, but it doesn't need to be like the purpose. It doesn't need to be purposeful. Then
can we take into account that it was not purposeful? Should we assume that it was not purposeful?
I don't think the record would. I don't think you could assume anything other than what's in the decision on summary judgment because of the standard. But I don't think the district court found purposeful. I think the district court found intentional. I think that's what that intentional but not purposeful is what you.
Well, intentional in that they were substantially certain that it would occur, but not purposeful in that what didn't have the purpose of eliciting good answer or answers to the questions. Is that the idea?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And I just want to end by saying if this court decides the Bivens issue sua sponte, it would be the first time that I'm aware of that the Court of Appeals decided the issue without the benefit of sequential briefing. In Bishri,
without the benefit of what?
Sequential briefing, a traditional brief by one party, followed by a responsive brief.
Did the Fifth Circuit even get supplemental briefing?
What?
Did the Fifth Circuit even get supplemental briefing in Oliva? Because they dropped a footnote and said the only argument was it was forfeited.
It was raised below, and the fact that the other side chose not to argue it is different than the court deciding it sua sponte. That's exactly the same facts in Bishri, where it was not raised sua sponte by the court. One of the many Bivens issues was not raised below. It was raised entirely on appeal. And one of the arguments in Bishri and that the plaintiff Capelli made was that it was forfeited below, but it wasn't raised sua sponte by the court, I think, in either case.
You can see that we, first of all, we have jurisdiction to consider it, and secondly, we have the discretion to consider it.
My view on jurisdiction is you don't, but I think you've heard me on that, and if you decide otherwise, then I just haven't convinced you. On discretion, I think you have some discretion, but I think that the court is behooved to follow its traditional, the traditional rules and standards it follows on waiver and forfeiture, because even an antecedent issue can be decided on such issues. In the Hicks versus Ferrara case in the Fourth Circuit, which is 965 F3D 302, said the exact same thing.
If we sent it back to the district, well, in effect, sent it back to the district court by not deciding it, in which case it would still be something that could be raised before the district court on remand, unless you succeed on at this level.
We are not saying it can't be raised on final judgment, so I don't know what posture the district court could decide it, since it already decided it on motion to dismiss.
Oh, I see. But then appeal from final judgment come up to us at that point, and at that point we could go through our standard sequential briefing. Is that the idea?
Yes.
And then, but then as the Third Circuit pointed out, it'd be a complete waste of resources if we're ultimately, you all would go through a trial and then we ultimately would find no cause of action.
But that's true of all 12b6 arguments, right? If this was a statute of limitations issue, that would still be true. I don't know.
Fair point. But if we don't get those, I'm in a lot of court.
I mean, we receive supplemental briefs here, so what's the problem with the briefing that we have?
So I think there his seizure at the border, this is not a Fourth Amendment case, then that would be something that might implicate national security, well, national security. But it's not. He'd already been seized.
So questioning of a suspected terrorist does not implicate national security?
I don't think there's anything in the record that indicates that Mr. Al-Hadi is a suspected terrorist.
All right, whatever, on the watch list. So someone on the watch list doesn't implicate national security.
I don't think that's actually in the record either. Mr. Al-Hadi has been.
I thought you alleged it.
We've alleged it, but we've been unable to confirm whether that's true or not.
But don't we have to accept your allegation?
At the summary, I think you would on appeal for motion to dismiss. I think on the summary judgment stage, you're.
We view it in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
Which is just the record. There's no evidence either way on the record.
Okay,
fair enough. We've abandoned any question one way or the other as to why he was.
I thought that denial of qualified immunity, we accept the plaintiff's version of facts, don't we? We have to.
I think in the motion to dismiss stage, you have to accept all the plaintiff's facts as true. If it's qualified immunity outside of summary judgment, it's the facts that as established, viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And then on appeal, in these circumstances, the district court's determination is it's not a no-go review. The district court's determination
what's
the facts is given.
Just one question. What's your best case that we can extend Bivens to this context? What case? Is it Carlson? Is it Bivens? What is it? There's three, right? There's Bivens, Carlson, and Davis.
I would say of those,
those are the only three.
I would
right?
say the best case is the Goulet case that came out of the Ninth Circuit after Hernandez.
So none of the Supreme Court cases.
Well, of the Supreme Court cases, Carlson, I'm not saying they're not helpful. I'd say that the U.S. Supreme Court, their most helpful case.
Okay.
Given the modernist of it would be the Goulet decision.
Carlson is an Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment case, right?
Yes.
I'm having trouble seeing how that helps you very much.
I think
it seems to me more like Bivens. You don't think it's more like Bivens?
The conditions of confinement, cruel and unusual punishment are the Eighth Amendment. I think the one thing you could say is the fact that it's under the Fifth Amendment in this case, because he's a pre-trial detainee, there wouldn't be any grounds counseling hesitation is required in the Sixth Circuit precedent, because there's no question that a pre-trial detainee is deserved at least the same rights as as someone who's been convicted under the Eighth Amendment.
I see. Thank you.
And then to go back to
thank you, counsel. You're out of time. Any further questions?
No.
Judge Rogers?
No.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. 5 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address two issues with respect to the Bivens question, the court's jurisdiction, as well as whether there was a waiver here, and then turn to qualified immunity. So first, to the extent there is any concern whether the court has appellate jurisdiction, that question is easily settled by Hartman, Wilkie, and Iqbal. Iqbal itself was an interlocutory appeal on denial of motion to dismiss, and the Supreme Court considered the Bivens analysis in that case, as did this court previously in Cubridi v. Convertino. So there's no question that this court has jurisdiction. Waiver is an inapplicable doctrine here, Your Honors, because the government hasn't raised this issue. We're merely responding to the court's own inquiry as to whether to create a new Bivens remedy in this new context. So waiver is of no concern to the court because we've not presented those arguments in this appeal. Of course, we've...
And you would not have if we had not raised it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So as far as the government was concerned, it was perfectly all right for us to go ahead and decide the qualified immunity issue at this point.
That's correct. We had appealed only Officer Bradley's entitlement to qualified immunity. But, of course, the court can consider the antecedent question as to whether a remedy is available at all. And as to qualified immunity, I think it is worth...
Could I ask one more question about the Abbasi issue?
Absolutely.
Before you leave it, and we just have a couple minutes. One of the factors that's looked at is the availability of some other way of addressing...
An alternative.
So if it's a case involving foreign relations, you know, you might have the Mexican government at your door, and you might get some relief that way.
the Supreme Court has never endorsed the proposition that clearly established law can be established at different levels of generality for different constitutional rights. The doctrine of qualified immunity applies in the same way for different constitutional rights. But there's simply no support.
How do you deal with Spencer?
Spencer, Your Honor, involved confinement for several months in the middle of winter. There was a leaky ceiling. The detainee in that case had a wet bed. The conditions in that case are much harder.